So good evening again. So last week I read a letter from the author of the book Awakening Joy, because you know, I told the story about how I had assisted the last 2 weeks of the February month-long at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and James Berez happened to be teaching it. And I was wringing my hands about what I was going to do for 6 weeks. And he said, do Awakening Joy. So he sent me a beautiful letter to read to you all. And so he actually watched the video of last week. And he was so grateful. You know, we all said thank you, James, on it, right? So he actually sent another letter. So he sent this to me this morning, actually. So this is from James Berez. He says, dear Seattle community, I was so happy to be with you via the video of last week's talk. Thank you, Bonnie, for sharing the principles with your beautiful spirit. A few words that I think are important to keep in mind while doing these practices. Some people have trouble with the word joy. It seems too over-the-top bubbly and cheerful. Don't let the word joy get in the way of your experience. I'm using joy to describe all of the healthy states of mind that bring us ease of well-being. Contentment, peace, happiness, delight, open-heartedness, to name a few. If the word joy snags your mind, please translate it to another more accessible word for you that authentically expresses what you are hoping to cultivate in these weeks. Well-being, contentment, delight, happiness, aliveness, and substitute that word whenever you see or hear joy. Another important point to understand is that a truly happy person is not happy all the time. Sadness, anger, fear, and other states are all part of being human. A truly happy person feels them all, but isn't overwhelmed by the difficulties and also appreciates the goodness in life when that's here. During these weeks, simply invite the mind and heart to open up to the goodness around and inside you so that you can be more engaged with all experience. It will be important to allow your experience to be just as it is. Don't try hard to be joyful or happy. It will be just be frustrating and work against you. The essence of what I'm calling joy comes down to being authentic with your actual experience and connected to yourself and the world around you. Through that authenticity and connection, we get in touch with our aliveness, the heart of what I call awakening joy. To deepen your intentions towards well-being, a central practice will be noticing a wholesome state or joy when it arises. Now, this is important. I'm going to say it again. To deepen your intention towards well-being, a central part will be noticing a wholesome state or joy when it arises. When we feel grateful or happy or calm or compassionate, it registers more deeply if we are present right in the middle of the experience. These moments are easy to miss unless we have our radar out for them. Pay attention to when you are feeling good. Notice with interest how it feels in your body and mind so you can directly experience it. This is different from vaguely knowing, I feel good. Rather, you're exploring with curiosity the landscape of well-being by feeling what it's like to feel good. When you're in the middle of an enjoyable moment, while walking, listening to music, watching a sunset, etc., don't miss it. Be present for these uplifting, joyful experiences. May you be happy and open to your life with kindness and interest. Have a great week. So should we thank him? Thank you, James! Thanks, James! So, I thought that was very sweet. So how was it for you guys this week? Actually, Beth, one of our Sangha members, was telling me that just from last week, she had a buddy. She got a buddy, and they were texting each other. So you might consider that, to work with your friends. So tonight's topic in the Awakening Joy series is, it's a combination of two things. It is intention and mindfulness. So I'm going to talk about those two for a while, and then maybe we can have a discussion. So right intention or right thought, it's actually one of the path factors. This is what the Buddha said about it. Or one of the things, one of the many things he said about it. Abandon what is unwholesome, O yogis. One can abandon the unwholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do so. If this abandoning of the unwholesome would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to abandon it. But as the abandoning of the unwholesome brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, abandon what is unwholesome. Cultivate what is wholesome, O yogis. One can cultivate the wholesome. If it were not feasible, I would not ask you to do it. If this cultivation of the wholesome would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to cultivate it. But as the cultivation of wholesome brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, cultivate what is wholesome. I love this because this really shows the Buddha's confidence in us. You know, he says right there, and he's talking to every single one of you yogis sitting out there, and this yogi, he says, if I didn't think you could do it, I wouldn't ask you to do it. Because you can cultivate it, I'm asking you to do it. So he's just expressing his confidence in us. And he's really smart. I think he probably, I mean, I really trust him. You know, that whole thing about the malleability and the fMRI. I mean, that's just one of the things that he really had the jump on in modern science. So if he says that we can do it, I think it's a good bet and we can, you know, trust that he knows what he's talking about. So that gives me confidence. It gives me confidence to know that, you know, training the brain is part of what he taught and we can do it. So, in addition to the Buddha, other smart people have talked about this topic. So this is about magga. Magga is a way to talk about the Eightfold Path. Each of the Eightfold Paths, each of the eight directions of the path or principles actually has a force to it. And together it's considered magga, the path of the fourths. So this is an old, kind of a wives' tale or a folk tale about an old Cherokee grandfather. And having Native ancestry, I like to bring in my Native forebears. So an old Cherokee grandfather is teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside me, he says to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it's between two wolves. One is evil. He has anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, lies, false pride, and ego. He continued, the other is good. He has wisdom, joy, peace, patience, serenity, determination, humility, kindness, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside you, my grandson, and inside every other person too. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. And now another one of our ancestors, that old indigenous elder Ajahn Chah. So many of you probably know who Ajahn Chah is. He's our spiritual grandfather. He was Jack Kornfield's teacher. He is the he was the head teacher in the Thai forest tradition. you know, all of those wonderful Western monks were studied with Ajahn Chah. So this is what he says. This path consists of virtue, concentration, and wisdom, sila samadhi panya, the framework for training the heart. Their true meaning is not to be found in these words, but dwells in the depth of our hearts. However, if the factors of the Eightfold Path are weak and timid, the defilements will possess our minds. If magga, the path, is strong and courageous, it will conquer and destroy the defilements. If it's the defilements that are powerful and brave, while the path is feeble and frail, the defilements conquer our hearts. As Dharma practice develops in the heart, these two forces have to battle it out every step of the way. It's like there are two people arguing inside the mind, but it's just the path of Dhamma and the defilement struggling to win domination of the heart. The path guides and fosters our ability to see clearly. As long as we are able to see clearly, the defilements will be losing ground. But if we are shaky, whenever defilements regroup and regain their strength, the path will be routed as defilements take its place. These two sides will continue to fight it out until eventually there is a victor and the whole affair is settled. It's essentially the same story, isn't it? So how do we do that? How do we work with right intention? So essentially, working with right intention is to understand what is wholesome and to let our behavior, our thoughts, our deeds, our actions, and our speech be guided by that, and to know when our thoughts, our speech, and our actions are the intention or informed by the intention of an unwholesome emotion. You know, intention is one of those universal characteristics found in the Abhidhamma. It says that every action that we do has an intention to it, but it's usually so quick, you know, oftentimes it's just very quick and, you know, we don't even know what's informing our actions, you know, our thoughts, our speech, or our actions. And it said that intention can either be wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral. So, and that's
what we're trying to accomplish by working with intention and right intention. So we're trying to, maybe slow ourselves down, strengthen our mindfulness, and to know when something that we want to do is informed by greed, hatred, and delusion, and the, you know, many, many manifestations of those three defilements, and when it's informed by something more wholesome. And just to, and it's not even to, get mad at ourselves or even repress when an unwholesome emotion comes up. In fact, we get to one point in the path where we're so happy to see unwholesome intentions because we can catch them. And we can work at, you know, opening to them, using our mindfulness to extract the wisdom out of just how, you know, they're really not the cause of any real happiness for us. And it actually allows, when we see clearly what is informing our behavior, we take mindfulness to it, and that allows wisdom to arise. And it's wisdom that does the purification. It's not our egos that do that. You know, us wanting to become better people and all of that, you know, there's probably some wholesome intention in that, but there's also a lot of selfing. And, what really works the best is to just see clearly what's happening in the moment and just rest and trust that this process, this path of mindfulness, will do the work that it needs to do. So this is a little piece by Matthew Ricard, and I'm sure many of you know Matthew Ricard. He's a wonderful Tibetan Buddhist monk. I think he's also a mathematician or something, right? He's a French scientist and also a Tibetan Buddhist monk. And this is a little piece on 10 things we think will make us happy but won't. The first one is to become rich, powerful, and famous. Number two, to treat the universe as if it was our mail order catalog for our desires and fantasies, as if it were a mail order catalog. Three, to yearn for the freedom to do everything that comes into our mind. This is not freedom, but being a slave to your own thoughts. Four, to constantly seek pleasant sensation one after the other. Pleasurable sensations soon become dull and often become unpleasant. Five, to maliciously take revenge on someone who has hurt you. That happened to me today. Or that arose in me today. Gosh, it's so helpful to have mindfulness. Doing so, you become as mean as them and poison your own mind. Six, if I had all that, I surely would be happy. Or if I don't get that, I can't be happy. Such predictions usually don't turn out to be true. Seven, to always be praised and never face criticism. This will never help you to progress. Number eight, to vanquish all of your enemies. Animosity never brings happiness. Nine, to never face adversity. This will make you weak and vulnerable. And 10, to put all of your efforts into taking care of just yourself. Altruistic love and compassion are the roots of genuine happiness. So those are some of the causes of our unhappiness. And that's actually one of the biggest, insights of right intention or right thought. You know, there's a lot said in Buddhism about renunciation. And I really, that word, I mean, how does that word renunciation sit with you? I don't like that word. It's like, you know, it seems to me, you know, it's probably just my Western, you know, my Western acculturation that, you know, we live in a culture that thinks that accumulation is where it's at. Accumulation of more of this or more of that. And, you know, it's what our economy is based on, unfortunately. On more accumulation and more spending. And, you know, unless we get, you know, some wisdom around what a common belief system is, or what, you know, what common sense is. That's actually common sense in our culture, that accumulation and all of these things actually will bring us happiness. But it's actually, you know, not very common sense at all. I mean, I think that we see it. And that's what we see with mindfulness. I mean, if we have to have, you know, me, I have a habit of having a bowl of ice cream before I go to bed at night. Actually, Anushka was, over the weekend, was talking about, you know, renunciation of ice cream. And I knew she was talking to me. She spent the weekend at my house, and, you know, every night we had really long talks, and I would sit there with my bowl of ice cream, and she'd say, "Bonnie, I'll have yogurt, please." So that was her excellent, you know, good influence over me. But what happens is, you know, I could try to put down ice cream, and, you know, I'm sure it's not doing me as, you know, that much harm, but, you know, what the trick is, or what the instructions are, is to use this wonderful, you know, technique of mindfulness, or this wonderful practice of mindfulness, to see really clearly, you know, what is the real outcome of these things that we think will make us happy. So, you know, it's really to extract the wisdom out of that. You know, one thing that James said too is that he's hoping that we will all do, and I'm hoping that we will all do it too, is to widen our intention for happiness. And in fact, I think that's part of what we're trying to do here. Once we really understand that this very solid self that, you know, we think is continuing and we think is the source of these desires and these wishes, once we see clearly with strong mindfulness, you know, that it's actually not what we think it is, then what happens is, just from that wisdom, it's really nothing that we even have to do, just from seeing that clearly, the wish for not only our own happiness, but the wish for happiness of others just rises without even any effort. So it's not like we need to, you know, I think it's very wholesome to do practices like the Brahmavihara practice in our meditation. You know, that's setting an intention to actually engage with the world with friendliness and engage with the world with compassion. And we can do that practice whether we feel it in the moment or not. It's really inclining the mind and creating those neural pathways. But really, you know, the thing that's going to have us, you know, that's going to water the seeds of these good qualities the most is really to have wisdom arise. And that wisdom arises from seeing clearly what the nature of reality is. You know, Anishka did it beautifully over the weekend, and I told her, I've actually used this a few times, it's that there's one definition of suffering that it equals. Suffering equals reality plus resistance. Right? So when we think relationships, and you know, one of the principle of that is, it's the three characteristics, right? The principle is that everything changes, or whatever has the nature to come together has the nature to break apart. So when we expect that not to be true, when we struggle with the reality of that, that's where our suffering comes from. And then when we expect, you know, as I discussed just now, when we think that accumulation of certain things, you know, the habit patterns of our culture, you know, seeking fame and fortune and accumulation, you know, as Matthew Ricard said so beautifully, if we treat the universe as if it was a mail order catalog for our desires and fantasies, you know, if we expect to get satisfaction from conditioned things, that's not going to happen. And then, you know, the third way that we struggle with reality is, you know, having an individual self, this belief in an individual self, or this experience of it. It's not even a belief, it's an experience. That's how we experience the world. When we don't see clearly, when our mind is deluded or filled with greed or aversion, we don't see clearly that we really don't have a lot of control over what happens. You know, we really can't determine that, you know, this is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to make these plans, and this is how my life is going to go. And this is what I need to be happy, and I'm going to make it happen. You know, for all of my Christian friends, they said, if you want to make God laugh, tell him what your plans are. So the second part of my talk is about mindfulness. Oh my gosh. Do we love mindfulness? I love mindfulness. So this is the claim of the sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta. It's really the, you know, one of the most I don't want to say it's the root teaching, because every, you know, each of the eight path factors are so important, but mindfulness is what allows us to practice the eight path factors, just knowing what's going on. So this is the claim of the sutta. This is the only way, O yogis, for the purification of being, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for reaching the right path, for the attainment of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So, you know, the way I like to language this is, and I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again, I love it, is that, you know, we have two knowledge systems, and this is one way that Rodney, you know, our beloved teacher, languages it, and other people do as well, is that we have two knowledge systems. We have our rational, linear, conceptual knowledge system, and then we have intuitive awareness. And, you know, I belong to, one of the many cultures I belong to is indigenous culture, and we're doing ceremony a lot that really relies on that indigenous, that intuitive awareness. You know, just a week ago we had sweat lodge ceremony and pipe ceremony for the changing of the season, and it was all intuitive awareness. It was all watering the seeds of gratitude for nature and the way it changes and how it nourishes us. But anyway, so intuitive awareness is what really sees reality. Concepts, you know, conceptual understanding is an overlay over reality. And intuitive awareness is where we really see the nature of reality. Even, you know, modern French philosophers are saying that. I mean, that's the basis for you academics out there of, you know, the critique of the metaphysics of presence and French post-structural philosophy. I mean, you know, Western thought is, you know, slowly catching up to what the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago. But so what mindfulness is, it's a non-conceptual taking in of information for our intuitive awareness. It just, you know, looks clearly at things as they're happening in our experience. And the Buddha taught, as many of you know, who've been doing mindfulness for 30 or 40 years, that, you know, the Buddha taught that there's four foundations of mindfulness, or four things to help train the mind in strengthening our mindfulness. The other thing I like to just remind myself or reflect on in mindfulness, that what it is, it's a capacity of our awareness, right? We have the capacity for it, but if you don't strengthen it, it's not there, you know. So you can, you have the capacity for it. I guess it's like any other thing that you work out or that you train in, that, you know, we could all probably become really fit athletes, but if we don't get to the gym or do our training, it's not going to happen. So the same is true of mindfulness, is that we all have this capacity. And some of the characteristics of mindfulness that I really like to reflect on are that one thing that, you know, one of the best books about mindfulness that's out right now that many of you probably read, in addition to my teacher Joseph Goldstein's wonderful book on mindfulness, is another book by the Venerable Analyo, who is a German Theravada monk. And he has a wonderful book out called Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. And actually, if you Google that book, you can download it free. It's available free online if you wanted to see it. But he says something specifically about mindfulness that I want to read to you. It's really beautiful. He says that mindfulness, one of the central tasks of mindfulness, or sati, is the de-automization of habitual reactions and perceptual evaluations. So think about that. So there's another very deep teaching in Buddhism about, that I really love, about distortions of perception. And what mindfulness does is it clears up those distortions so we don't automatically think the same thing that we always think. In fact, one of the interesting points in James's book is that 90% of every thought we've had before. So, you know, only 10% of any thought we have is actually a new thought. And of those 90% of thoughts that we continually have, 80% of them are negative. That's if, you know, we aren't training in mindfulness and training to just be aware of what's floating around our mind. So I do want to talk about, just briefly about the vipalasas, because this is something that's, you know, very prevalent. You know, they say that if we're not seeing the three characteristics as we just go about and walk in life, if we're not seeing the dissatisfactoriness or the lack of fulfillment in conditioned experience, if we're not seeing that, then, you know, our perceptions or our what we're taking in is distorted. If we're not seeing the truth of impermanence, that things are changing all the time, our perception is distorted. And if we're thinking that we're in control of everything and that everything is happening to me, then, you know, our thinking is distorted. But this is how it happens. Actually, this is what the Buddha taught, and a lot of actually modern business leadership types have actually taken this up. Peter Senge, for one. This is the way that he languages this. And so on the most fundamental level, in our perceptional level, there's data for us to perceive in the world. And we observe data. We're observing data all the time. But, you know, there's so much going on, we have a very selective, we select data from what it's possible to observe based on what? You know, based on what we think is interesting or sexy or, you know, create strong positive sensations in us. And based on that selective intake of data, we make assumptions about the world. And then we, you know, we've taken the data, and then we add meaning to it as well. You know, we're add meaning, well, this is what this means, this is what that means. And for example, I'll give you an example. I was at the February, you know, assisting with the February 2-week retreat. Should I tell you this? I'm going to tell you. And there was a yogi that I've known for a very long time. And, you know, I've always had a, you know, interesting relationship with this yogi. And she actually was so brilliant. She was in the middle of a month-long retreat, and she came in and talked to her, who she was interviewing with, and was so beautiful the way she talked about, yeah, I heard Bonnie Duran was coming, and that really created a reaction in me. But she just walked through how she was able, because her mindfulness was so strong, she said, wow, look at that reaction. And she was able to really see what happened when we actually got together. And, you know, it was so beautiful to see what mindfulness did. It totally broke that habitual perception she had of what was going to happen. It was so beautiful. And then after the retreat, we actually got together. And she, you know, she said, I want to give you some feedback on your Dharma talks. And she just gave me some of the best feedback I ever had. And it was because, you know, based on, you know, how useful it was for her to let go of her perception of who I was, I said, I'm going to get me some of that. And I let go of my perception of who I thought she was. And it was just so useful. And I think that, you know, that lesson to me is true of everything. If we know what something is, you know, that teacup is full. There's nothing to be learned in there. So I think, you know, taking a lesson from our Mahayana relatives, you know, our Zen relatives, beginner's mind is so useful because it really is the reality and the truth of things. If we can let go of how we think things are going to be. So that was a way to describe, you know, how I added meaning to that perception in the moment. And based on that, you know, we draw conclusions about our reality in the moment. You know, we see data we want to see, we have selective observation, we impute meaning to it, we draw conclusions. And those conclusions, you know, if they're not understanding those three characteristics of reality, they're pretty much wrong. And then we adopt beliefs about the world based on those conclusions that we draw. And we take actions in the world, we make the decisions of our life, we, you know, our thoughts, our actions, and our speech are based on those, you know, those beliefs that we adopt that really probably have very little basis in reality. And that's what mindfulness does. Mindfulness allows us, you know, one of the specific functions of mindfulness is it breaks down that habitual way that we see life. You know, it allows us to take in maybe more data, and it allows us to, you know, even understand or see more clearly the meaning that we impute to that, and, you know, maybe see it more clearly for what it is. And then based on that, you know, we have more clarity and more wisdom about what's happening in our life. And based on that clarity and wisdom, we make decisions that are really much better for others and for ourselves as well. Mindfulness rocks. So what about the tyranny of mindfulness? Does anybody have a tyranny of mindfulness going on in their hearts? So mindfulness is not a bulldog herding us back to the breath. You ever feel that way? Like, it's, you know, as soon as you feel, you realize that your mind has wandered, which, you know, you don't have control of either, it's like, oh, I can't believe I did that. There I go again. I have no strength of mind. Rather than saying, wow, how cool, with kindness, oh, yeah, I'm awake again. I can come back to my anchor for a moment. Some of us can use mindfulness as a method of self-judgment. We can hate ourselves into, we can't hate ourselves into being a better person. And then for, I actually use this line, you know, sometimes I teach in Indian country. I did a couple days of mindfulness, you know, day-long retreats on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And actually one of my colleagues, Michael Yellowbird, calls mindfulness neuro-decolonization. It's cool. It is, because we all need to colonize. We have all been colonized by greed, hatred, and delusion. And we can use mindfulness to really uproot a lot of that. And when I'm teaching on the Pine Ridge Reservation, I've said stuff like, let's not superimpose the violence of colonization into our mindfulness. Let's not, you know, beat ourselves up for actually having a good intention and sitting down to practice. Another way to combat the tyranny of mindfulness, you know, the judgment of a wandering mind, is to take an ancestral lens. You know, what do you think that your ancestors want for you right now? Those who, you know, might have whether colonization here or more broadly, those, you know, your ancestors that got on a rickety boat to come over here and make a better life for themselves and for their kids and grandkids. You know, they sacrificed a lot for us. What do you think that they would want for you now? So, before I open it up for a discussion, we do have some homework for the week, and I'll give it to Jonathan to post. So the homework for the week is actually to pick, okay, so you have a week, so you have 7 days, so you might consider doing this. Don't beat yourself up if you don't do it, but you might consider doing it. Pick, you know, maybe your most predominant defilement. For me, I used to really have a lot of self-pity, and I didn't even realize I had it. You know, I would just really slink around. It really zapped me of a lot of energy. My poor mom has it too, or she had it when I was growing up. She had a lot of self-pity. Well, you know, she felt powerless a lot, and I kind of internalized that. And, you know, when I was able to see it clearly through mindfulness, putting a frame around it, I was able to decondition it. You know, that's what mindfulness does. It holds our experience between suppression and indulgence, between denial and obsession. You know, it holds it in the middle of those two things. And when we can see something clearly, just see it clearly in mindfulness and decide, yeah, that's something I want to cultivate or something I don't want to cultivate, you know, that decision is made by wisdom. When we see clearly what that is, that decision is made by wisdom. So one exercise for this week would be to take your predominant defilement, whether it's delusion, not seeing clearly, greed, you know, if there's a lot of wanting in your mind, or aversion, and just take that day to watch when greed arises in your mind. Or take that day to see, you know, you're going to have a mindfulness belt go off when aversion rises in your mind. How many things can you dislike today? Just count them up. You guys are all laughing because you know that there's a lot, right? Or how many things are you greedy for today? You know, or how many times are you missing what's happening today? So that's one exercise for the week. And I'll actually post others as well. You know, it's interesting because the Awakening Joy Course, I think, is intended for people who are, one, really don't have a mindfulness practice, and I know many of you here, you guys have very deep practices for many, many years. So we are so on the cutting edge of happiness. We are. It is like right there. We have all the tools to be happy, to really incline our mind to happiness and to cultivate those neural pathways and those positive qualities all the time. We are on the cutting edge of that. So we should be reflect on our own goodness for a second. So, let's open it up. Should I do the Vinnie Ferraro thing? What did you hear? So you can tell me what you heard, or comments, questions, or gentle challenges. Iris?
I really appreciated James's letter at the beginning, because I was struck this last week by how infrequently I was aware of feeling joy. And but I did have moments of pleasure and happiness and, you know, occasional contentment and this and that. And so just sort of enlarging the whole concept makes me feel a lot more hopeful about moving in this direction. So
excellent.
I liked that and a lot of other things.
Excellent. So what I'm hearing you say, Iris, is that it worked for you this week to incline your mind to just be much more aware of when happiness was there. Excellent.
And I was surprised, actually not terribly surprised, because I know my mind fairly well at this point, by how much of the time happiness was not there.
Happiness was not there.
Yeah. You know, it's a bit sad that I was just holding it all. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's beautiful. Did you hear what she said? She said she was surprised how much time happiness wasn't there, but, you know, she was holding it all. So that was wisdom. That was, I heard equanimity there. That's beautiful. Any other suggestions for something that worked for you this week? Beth told us that she had a buddy, and that worked for her. They were texting each other things that made them happy, I guess. Is that what it was?
Yeah, we had the assignment of texting each other each day where joyful observations brought us joy.
Excellent.
It was good. It was interesting to just, to share and to get a little window into another person's life. It was actually wonderful.
Yeah, intimacy. Intimacy is the opposite of loneliness. And that's another thing that I have suffered from in the past, loneliness. And when you realize, I mean, I've had meditation experiences, and this is the other part of this awakening joy is that, you know, the Buddha taught that there are so many wonderful, high pleasure things that can happen actually through meditation practice and just being present. And meditation practice doesn't necessarily mean jhanic level, you know, 3-month retreats. It means continuity. It means continuity of mindfulness. Just being present can actually create quite a bit of joy in your mind. But I actually had this handout or this little story about Sylvia Boorstein that James wanted me to read, and I didn't bring it, so I'm going to tell you this story. It's a cute little story. So, and it's actually in the book Awakening Joy, and you guys probably know who Sylvia Boorstein is, don't you? She's a wonderful, very long-time teacher at a spirit walk. I actually saw her during when I was there for 2 weeks. I actually read her tarot cards. I felt so blessed by her. While I was reading her cards, she was just giving me all this wisdom. It was so beautiful. But anyway, there's a story about how she's in New York City visiting a friend, and she has concert tickets or theater tickets, and she decides to take the bus. She's on a bus, and you know, the traffic in Manhattan is really terrible. So she says, oh my gosh, I could do better if I just got off the bus and hurried to the theater. So she gets off the bus and starts running towards the theater, going as fast as she can. She's all dressed up, she's got high heels on, and actually as she's running down the street with her high heels, of course the bus goes by, right? And she just got off. And she said, oh man, I should have stayed on the bus. How silly and, you know, unaware am I? And here she is running down the street with these high heels on, and then it dawns on her. This is called reframing, and many of you mental health therapists, you know this phrase, reframing, right? She says, wait a minute, you know, she was really unhappy because she was, you know, running down the street, she didn't have her bus, she wasn't on the bus, and she thought she would be late for the theater, and then, you know, she reframed and she says, what am I talking about? I'm 70 years old, I'm running down the street in Manhattan, all dressed up with high heels on, and people are looking at me, and gosh darn, I'm happy they're looking at me. Right? I mean, that's just one example of, you know, there's probably, you know, everything that we have a negative take on, there's probably an appropriate reframing. So let's take some advice from Sylvia. Anything else? Any other things that worked for you this week? Did anyone else try to have more joy in their life? Did anyone try it? Dennis, did you try to have more joy?
Yeah, no, it was definitely, I felt the impact of really taking in your words last week. And just a myriad of ways, I think I really appreciated a deeper level of intimacy with Diane and just really feeling the joy of that relationship more than I let in. And there's little things. Today I read in the paper that there's a baby boom among the L-pod of orcas in Puget Sound. You know, I've been like, you know, worried about L-pod.
There's
hear that, should we let that in? And, you know, among my neighborhood challenges, there's pockets of hope.
Wow. That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
So did you hear what he said?
No.
Okay, so Dennis Martinovich is right here. He's a CDLer, and his wife is sitting right behind him, Diane Hedrick. She's the wonderful person teaching the compassion cultivation training that had 80 people last week. That made me so happy. And he was just saying that, you know, he's been, how long have you guys been married, like 30 years or something? More than 30? Oh my gosh. And he was just loving his wife this week. How sweet. So he was able to bring that joy of just, you know, having a marriage where they're still into the same things. And then he said that the L-pod, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
The L-pod?
Yeah.
Which
the
is
orca-pod.
The orca pod in here, the Puget Sound, is it on the San Juans or something? Is having a baby boom. Is that what you called it, a baby boom?
That's what this, that was the headline in the paper.
Yeah, headline.
Baby boom, or L-pod, four babies.
Four babies. That is so cool. That's great. That makes me joyful. Anybody else do it? Anybody else try? Yeah?
I spent several hours last Sunday with four young boys who are not members of my family. And I wasn't babysitting, I wasn't teaching them, it wasn't some kind of obligation to be with these boys. And it was just total joyfulness the whole time. And I'm just reflecting on how children are so easily able to access joy and to share it with us adults.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. You all heard that, right? She got to hang out with kids, and kids actually can be quite joyful. I saw some other hands. Carla Prater.
In the midst of all the bad things that were happening when I was autistic, I just had huge waves of gratitude for the fact that I can actually do something to help people. Mm-hmm. And so the gratitude is just the best, most joyful thing ever.
That is so beautiful. So Carla was saying, in the midst of some pretty tumultuous family things happening, she was able to take quite a bit of joy in the fact that she actually could be there to help them. That she had resources to help them. That's beautiful. I said something over here.
One of the things that you suggested was that we do physical activity. I was having a kind of a crappy day. So I got on my bike and was riding my bike along. And then there was a homeless man holding a sign that said, "Almost bad, anything helps?" And I stopped my bike and I said, "I don't have any money to give you, but will you take a hug?"
Oh.
And so he said, "Sure. You know, I come from a family of huggers, but I haven't had a hug in a long time."
Wow.
And so we spent a little bit of time just hugging on the street corner. And then he said, "Oh, that was $1 million hug."
Oh.
So that made me feel better.
That's beautiful. Did you guys hear that? She was saying that she went for a bike ride to try to get some exercise, and she came across a homeless man, and she didn't have any money, but she said to him, "I don't have any money, but can I give you a hug?" And he said, "You know, I'm from a family of huggers, and I haven't had a hug in a long time." So she gave him a really good hug, and he said, "That's $1 million hug." That was better than a $20 bill, probably. That was beautiful, thank you. Any one last one before we go? It was, I was very joyful and happy to be able to be, there's a term called a kapya. Do you guys know what a kapya? It's an attendant for a Buddhist teacher. So I was so happy to be Anushka's attendant this weekend, her kapya. So that made me happy. And we have some announcements. Our beloved chairman of the SIMS board, Joyce, is going to give us an announcement.